liberty to say a few things that I have in mind. We'll see how it goes. I'm in the book of John. We're going to start with the 9th chapter. And as Jesus passed by, okay. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. That's what Alan was talking about in our Sunday school. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said unto him, Go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. He went his way, therefore, and washed, and came seeing. The neighbors, therefore, and they which before had seen him that he was blind, said, Is not this he that sat and begged? Some said, This is he. Others said, He is like him. But he said, I am he. I'm the man that sat and begged, that was blind from my mother's womb. And I can now see. Therefore said they unto him, How were thine eyes opened? He answered and said, A man that is called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said unto me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed, and I received sight. Then said they unto him, Where is he? He said, I know not. Jesus didn't stay around for hang around for accolades or praise or blessings. I have a story to tell, and I know some of you here have heard it, but I think there's some here that haven't heard it. And I've refrained from telling it too often, and I hope the Lord doesn't think I'm ashamed of him or his working with me. But I do not wish to embarrass my daughter. She's much like this blind man. She was a victim. She didn't ask for that accolade. It just happened. She was about 6 months old, and she was a very energetic little baby. And she used to stand in her crib, hanging onto the upper rails, and she'd bounce and bounce, and she'd get about 6 bounces, and then she'd just throw herself backwards on the mattress, and she liked that feeling. Kind of a fluffy, bouncy feeling. And she was born in April, and we were recognizing the day a party or a group together to do something in answer to Halloween. So she was about a little over 6 months old when this happened. And that morning when we left to go, or when we, that afternoon when we left to go to where the doings were being held, she had a little bit of a cold. And we left her with her grandmother because it was going to be, it's chilly in Michigan in October. And knowing that she had a runny nose and a cold, we left her with her grandmother. We were there about an hour and a half. We got a phone call. Said, you better get here quick. Something's wrong. She didn't say what was wrong. She just said, something's wrong. Well, we got there, and Sharon was carrying a fever. She couldn't close her eyes. She just stared into space. And she didn't cry. She didn't respond in any way. You tickled her, there was no response. There was no giggle, there was no smile, there was nothing. And her mother, my mother-in-law, my wife's mother, Sister Adams, I don't know if anybody knows Gertrude Adams or not, but Judy Adams was taking care of her. And she had asked her husband, the pastor of our local there, Leslie, her husband's name was Leslie Wilbur Adams, she had had him administer to her. Well, when I got there immediately, Dad and I administered to her again. And we could see that she was not responding. And I was scared. And I think my wife was too. She didn't express fear, but she just expressed that she just didn't know what to do. And so, speaking to my father-in-law, I said, if something happens to her, I don't want them to be accusing me or my wife of not getting her the proper care. So I said, I'm going to take her to the hospital. He said, I think you should. He said, I wouldn't ask you to do that. I wouldn't tell you to do that. But he said, I think you made the right decision. He said, you should do that. So we did. Well, there was about five hospitals in Flint at that time. There was Flint, there was Hurley Hospital. Can't think of the names of any of them now. Of Catholic Hospital, St. Joseph. The Women's Hospital where we took her, which was the closest to where we lived. And then went out on Beachy Road, and there was another one that lived right downtown, the main part of town. Well, we went to the one that was closest to where her parents lived. Went in the emergency room and told them that, you know, we didn't know what the trouble was, but we knew that there was something wrong. Well, they give a quick diagnosis, and they rushed her into emergency care in what they called a secluded room. And there they took a spinal tap. Well, of course, I had to sign papers saying that they could do all this. They wouldn't even tell us what their suspicions were, but they said that they had to have some spinal fluid to find out if their suspicions were correct or not, and they hoped that they were wrong. They took the test, they rushed her to the lab. In the meantime, they had began washing her eyes with something, I suppose it was saline water. They had a hose that would suck the phlegm and stuff out of her mouth. And there was a nurse with her all the time. And they had her hooked up to where the monitors that showed her heartbeat and heart rate and temperature and all that stuff. So we knew it was serious, but we didn't know how serious it was. And they came back and they said, she has spinal meningitis. Well, I didn't know what that meant, except I knew that was bad. And so they rushed her to ICC. They put her in ICC. And this was a place where you could only one person at a time go in there. There was at least one and usually two, sometimes three nurses were there all the time. But there was always at least one person there all the time. To go into this room, you had to take off everything except what you'd wear. I mean, this is where I went in. I couldn't wear a suit coat or overcoat vest or anything. I'd take everything else off. You put on a surgically clean robe. And then somebody else puts a pair of gloves on you, and they put a mask over your face. And you feel like, you know, I've done something wrong. That's just to go in there. Then you get in there, you can't touch her. You can be there with her, and you can talk to her. But you can't tell if she hears you or not. And there was no response whatever. I mean, no smile, no emotion at all in her body. So, they asked us what we had done when we took her to the hospital, of course. They wrote all this stuff down, and we said that we had been treating her for a cold, and what medication she had been given, who her doctor was. Once she was last time she'd been to the doctor, they just asked every imaginable question you can imagine. And in the course of answering the questions, Joe had explained to them that she had been administered to twice by the elders of our church, and that we believed in healing by faith and prayer. Anyway, when they got her stabilized, what they call stabilized, they asked Joe and I to go with them into a separate room, a consultation room is what they called it. And they went over all the information that they had. They asked us if that was correct. And to the best of our ability, we said yes, what was correct was correct. Then this a doctor of some authority in the hospital. This was called McLaren General Hospital. And it had formerly been called a women's hospital because it dealt primarily with women's diseases and women's problems. Anyway, this representative from the hospital, this officer from the hospital, he said, you know, he said, we have a very serious situation here. He said, it appears there's child neglect here. And we want you to be prepared for that. Do you wish to have an attorney present? And I stood up and I said, now look. I said, three hours ago, she was a normal, healthy baby with a cold. She came down with whatever this problem is when she couldn't close her eyes and her breathing became and panting and her temperature rose. I said, we came here looking for help. We didn't come here looking for criticism. I said, whatever you may think, I said, my wife is a good child, good mother and good to her children. I said, if you have any questions about her ability as a mother or as a caretaker for this child, so you talk to her doctor. And I didn't know it at the time, but he was on their staff. And I give him his name, his Dr. James Morrissey, address, one thing or another. Well, I seen them look at each other, you know, and this one guy just kind of shut his, raised his eyebrows like, I don't know. But I didn't know what that meant. Well, a few minutes later, Dr. Morrissey came into the room. And I said, doctor, I said, we're very, very glad to see you. I said, there seems to be some thought here that maybe Joe was neglectful as a parent. Well, he says, she certainly is not. And he went on to explain. And if it hadn't been for the fact that he was practically there, or just there, I mean, we came that close to being accused of being neglectful parents. And I was irate, and when I get angry, I do exude a little power, anger, whatever the right word is. I know I've several people told me, I've never seen you angry before. I never knew you could act like that. I said, that's not how I act. It just happens. It's just, I don't control it. I just don't allow it to get control of me very often. But, and I think that when this doctor raised his eyebrows, I think that he was really meaning that he had security outside the door. At the time, I didn't know that. But anyway, they came in. He was mostly responsible for her treatment at the hospital. It took her 5 days to recover from this spinal meningitis. That is to get to the point where she could come out of intensive care, out of the secured care, nursing care. And in the same consultation room, they sat down with us a few days later. And this time, Dr. Morrissey was in charge. And he said, you know, that with meningitis, it affects the five senses of the body. We don't know what senses will be impaired. We do know that her eyes didn't have enough moisture on for a long time. But she said, as near as we can tell by inspection, there's nothing wrong with her eyes. But one, or perhaps two, or some combination of the five senses will undoubtedly be impaired because of this disease. When we know what it is, we will deal with it. But right now, we don't know what it is because we can't isolate it. We can't identify it. We can't tell where it is. And you never get to the point where you say, well, I want my child, even if she is going to be blind, or even if she is going to be deaf, or even if she is going to be maimed in some way. I never thought that thought. I never accepted that thought. I was confident. Maybe I was even cocky. I hope I wasn't cocky, but I was more than just a little bit confident that she wasn't going to be affected in any way. The doctor also told us that her chances of survival were good, that we had taken her to the best of the hospitals in Flint that could deal with this. They had the facilities to deal with. There was only one other hospital that could deal with meningitis, and they didn't make a distinction between a communicable and non-communicable spinal meningitis. communicable meningitis is caused by a virus or some kind of an organism anyway. The non-communicable meningitis was caused by a blow or an accident that caused something to injure her physical body, and it caused the infection then that developed into meningitis of the infection of the spine, which developed into meningitis. And because hers was the result of a blow, and the doctors have assumed that the blow came when she fell backwards in her crib sometime or other, she hit her head on one of her toys, and the plastic toy was hard enough or resistant enough that it caused the injury that created the situation, began the situation that caused meningitis. The doctor told us that he had two other meningitis patients in the hospital, and they were both past the critical stage, and they were on the mend, and he was glad that we had selected this hospital to take her. And like I say, we didn't select it. We just went there because it was what we thought was the closest and most convenient. Later on that week, a day or two later, I think it was the next evening, he came to me with very sad look on his face. He said, "I think you need to know this." And I expected the worst for Sharon. He said, "We just lost my most promising prospect of meningitis children." I said, "No." He said, "Yeah." He said, "We thought he was ready to be released tomorrow. He died a half hour ago." And of course, that makes you very apprehensive, very concerned, very worried. Well, we never used the term miracle in his presence. I don't remember ever using the term miracle in his presence. Joe might have, but I didn't. But when this was all over and done, and she had recovered, and by the way, they could not, they tested and tested and retested because they were sure there would be some deterioration or some malfunction or some problem with her eyesight or her hearing or her taste or her reflexes, and nothing, they couldn't find nothing. And Dr. Morrissey always referred to her whenever she came in the office as my miracle baby. And of course that was most reassuring or helpful or the best thing he could do as far as Joe was concerned. I mean, she was not one to boast or make that statement herself, but it just really pleased her an awful lot when he referred to Sharon as his miracle baby. And she did have one other physical impairment, I guess you might call it, but it had nothing to do with the meningitis. When she got about another 4 or 5, however old she was when she started to walk, we noticed as she walked, she swung one foot ahead of the other. She had to walk around each other, each foot. She just didn't roll forward. She had to go like this. And we took her to a pediatrician, I think that's the right word, and they measured the legs and the bone density, the bone strength, and a lot of things. But anyway, they came up with the idea that she wasn't because she had started walking too soon. It was because of the way that her bones were, from the knee down, the way the bone was twisted. And so he put wedges in her shoes, and he said she will probably never be able to run like a normal child, but she will be able to walk. He didn't tell Sharon that. And we had to, every time we bought her a pair of shoes, we had to take them to the doctor and have wedges put in there for a long time. And the wedges kept getting smaller and smaller, and her feet kept getting straighter and straighter. But she never accepted that as an impairment, and she can run just as fast as she ever could. I'm not sure how fast she can do it now, but it was never an impediment for her all the time that she was in the Peace Corps, or all the time that she was making her bicycle trip around the country, or anything that she's ever attempted to do. That was never brought forth in her mind as an impediment or as something to prevent her from doing what she wanted to do. And I'm thankful for that. I hope this doesn't sound like I'm bragging. I don't mean it that way at all. But the same thoughts did occur to me as occurred to these people here. Who's at fault, Master? Did the baby sin? Of course not. Did his parents sin? Well, who else could have? And he said there it was not because either one had sinned, but rather to show the ability of God to this world. I have often likened our experience that we had that afternoon or that morning, well, I guess it was evening actually, by the time we got to the hospital, it was probably around 9 or 9:30 of an evening. And so when all this happened, or sometime after that, as being taken, as this man was afraid of, or as his parents were afraid of, being taken before the elders. And their problem was not with the fact that a miracle had been done, but the day on which the miracle had occurred. This could not be the Messiah healing a man on the Sabbath, because he wasn't supposed to work, and because of all the Jewish laws pertaining to the Sabbath. And that whole story is contained there in that ninth verse. And they could not be certain in their mind whether this was the same man or an imposter, whether the man that was healed was really healed, or whether he was somebody else that they had selected just to look like the man that was healed. And so they sent for his parents. Well, let's just go ahead and read that story. We won't get through it all, but we'll get through what we can. They brought to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind, and it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. And again the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He said unto them, "He put clay upon mine eyes, and I washed, and do see. You notice he never did say he spat on the ground. He just said he made clay. He didn't see. He didn't know. That's right. But he told them what he knew. He said, "He put clay upon mine eye, and I washed, and I do see." Therefore said some of the Pharisees, "This man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day." Others said, "How can a man that is a sinner do such miracles?" And there was a division among them. And they say unto the blind man again, "What sayest thou of him, that he that hath opened thine eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him that had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, "Is this your son, who ye say was born blind? How then doth he now see?" His parents answered them and said, "We know that this is our son, and that he was born blind. But by what means he now seeth, we know not. Or who hath opened his eyes? We know not. He is of age. Ask him. He shall speak for himself." And these words spake his parents, because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. So this was the penalty that this man was going to pay if he admitted that he thought that this was Christ. I mean, that's all like a real big thing, but it's like saying they had the right to take away from him all that was his as a Jew, all that was his as his birthright. Therefore said his parents, "He is of age, ask him." So then they called the man that was blind, and said unto him, "Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner." And he answered and said, "Whether he be a sinner or no, I know not. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see." Then said they to him again, How did he do? No, excuse me. What did he do to thee? No. I'm trying to put too many words in there. What did he to thee? How opened he thine eyes? The blind man answered them and said, I have told you already, and ye did not hear. Wherefore would ye hear it again? Would ye also be his disciples? Then they reviled him. That angered them. When he asked them if they wanted to be his disciples, whom they were trying to discredit, they reviled him and they said, Thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciple. We know that God spake unto Moses. As for this fellow, we know not from whence he is. The man answered and said unto them, Why herein is a marvelous thing, that ye know not from whence he is, and yet he hath opened mine eyes. Now we know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshipper of God, and doeth his will, him he heareth. Since the world began, was it not heard that any man opened the eyes of one that was blind, that one that was born blind? If this man were not of God, he could do nothing. They answered and said unto him, Thou wast altogether born in sins, and dost thou teach us? They did cast him out. They kept their word. His parents weren't cast out, but he was, because he would not deny that Jesus had healed him. Whether it was a Sabbath or whether it was not, it didn't matter to him. He could see. Now Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he had found him, he said unto him, Jesus asked the blind man, or the man that had been blind, Dost thou believe on the Son of God? He answered and said, Who is he, Lord, that I might believe on him? And Jesus said unto him, Thou hast both seen him, and it is he that talketh with thee. And the man who had been blind said, Lord, I believed. And he worshipped him. And Jesus said, For judgment I am come into this world, that they which see not might see, and that they which might see might, excuse me, and that they which see might be made blind. Much of Christ's teachings or experiences that he had with the authorities and the knowledgeable people at that time were of this type of a nature, kind of contradictory, kind of questionable, kind of putting them in a bad light and accusing them of being too willing or too quick to rely on their own strength and their own, what they had seen and experienced, instead of relying upon him and upon faith in him. It's a lesson there for all of us to see, if we want to see it. But it's one of those lessons that you don't pick up on unless you want to recognize it for what it is. And some of the Pharisees which were with him heard these words and said unto him, Are we blind also? It wasn't like Christ had tried to hide this statement or this accusation from the people. And they were curious. Does this include us? Are we included in what you're talking about? And Jesus said unto them, If ye were blind, ye should have no sin. But now ye say, We see. Therefore, your sin remaineth. You are guilty. You are in sin. And this is the thing I think that we all need to acknowledge, be aware of, and strive to do something about. As long as we live in this world, we are capable of sin. I know I am concerned for my own welfare, my own well-being many times. And I know the feeling that Paul tried to express when he said, I fear daily lest I become a castaway. I look forward to hope that there will come a time in my life when I can look as Paul did and say, I have run a good race. I have finished the course. And I know that there's a crown laid up for me in heaven. I hope that each one of us can come to that point in life. I hope that we come to that assuredness or that, what's the right word? I know we all have faith that we're doing the right thing. We're going the right way. We're applying ourselves in the right manner. But faith and knowledge are so separate and so easily confused that sometimes we think that we know something. We're convinced in our mind that we are right, so we say that we know it, when really we don't know. We just know that we don't know anything else. And we want to believe that it is right. And therefore we, we substitute our confidence for knowledge. And I don't say that to be critical or to find fault, but I say that to point out that we've got to be very careful when I say, I know I seen something, or I know I experienced something, what it is that we really experienced. I know there was some feelings of not being sure how we took what everything was said here this morning on the Sunday school. And I don't know how to explain this other than to just tell you what happened. I've heard many testimonies of other people that I knew of things that they seen happen that there was no physical explanation for. I've heard my dad and one of his brothers, one of my uncles, tell how there was a place close to where they lived. And in those days, they didn't have a car. Everything was horse and buggy or Saint Smear or walking. And there was a home. It was about a quarter of a mile away. And they knew it was empty. There was nowhere to live there for several years. But occasionally, on an evening, the windows would be lit. There'd be noises of laughter and merriment coming out of the house. And they would go down to see what was going on. Because, well, who moved in and when did they get here? And they could hear and see this going on until they got to the driveway. When they walked up the driveway, the lights all went out and the sound quit. This is scary to me. This is spooky stories to me. So that's the first time I've ever repeated that story, at least in a capacity like this. But Dad had told me that story by himself. At other times, my uncle had told me the same story. They had went with him to see it. I can't explain it, and they didn't try to. They just said, all we know is it happened. We never got hurt by it. It never affected them, but said, you know, you don't tell things like that just to anybody. Well, the day that Joe was recovering from her second operation, we had been there for quite a long time. And I was there, and Tim and my grandsons were there, and Glenn and Mildred were there. And I don't remember, I think Sharon, yeah, I know Sharon was with us because she's the one who went back up to Joe's room. And Sharon was with us. And we went to a restaurant where we could eat at a buffet because everybody wanted something different. And wasn't too far from the hospital, and we didn't want to be too far away. And I had left the pager that you wear, you know, when you have a heart transplant, when you're an organ donor recipient, and you know that there is a donor organ about to be delivered, they give you a pager. Not that they expect you to be anywhere but in the hospital, but if you are, you're supposed to have this pager or not. Well, anyway. The operation was over. She had been successful in the operation, was coming out of the anesthesia, was in the recovery room, and we'd been there for, oh gosh, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours, maybe quite a long time anyway, and everything was going good. So we went to the restaurant. For whatever reason, I didn't take that pager with me. I thought it was over. While we were there eating, I'd finished my meal. I don't know what I ate now, but anyway, I knew I was done before everybody else. And Ethan and Jakey, they had a little bit like Independence Center. They had a play area there for kids to play. They had a railroad where train, get on the train and go around the track. They had a Ferris wheel and various things like that in there to entertain children. And Ethan wanted to go down and ride the train. I said, okay. So we went down there, and I was sitting there watching him ride the train, him and Jakey. Well, maybe not. Maybe Jakey was back at the table with Sharon. I'm not sure. I know Ethan and I were there. And while he was riding that train, I experienced something I've never experienced before. I've never seen ghosts. I've never seen visions. I've never had dreams where I thought anybody tried to talk to me. But Joe's spirit came by and said goodbye to me. And I knew she was gone. And Ethan got off the train. He came up to me, he took my hand, he said, "What's the matter, Grandpa?" Excuse me. He said, "What's the matter, Grandpa?" And I said, "Well, nothing, son. I said, everything's going to be okay." So he got done playing. We went back to where they were at the table. And in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, this is probably not true. You're just expecting the worst. I'm not going to say anything. We got back there, and there was no hurry, and yet they weren't just sitting around drinking coffee and talking to them. When everybody was done, we got together, got in the car, and drove back to the hospital. As we were coming in the hospital, Brother Jensen and his wife were coming down the escalator. And he walked up to us, and he said, "I'm so sorry to see you under these circumstances." He said, "My heart and my prayers with you." He says, "May God be with you." I said, "Thank you." And he excused himself and left. Of course, everybody wanted to go up to see Grandma, and there's only let two people go in there at a time. And so I told Ethan, I said, "Let's you and I go over by the waterfall." They had in the ante room or the foyer lobby, whatever you call it, they had a huge lobby with one of these self-supporting waterfalls. They pump the water up the inside, and you see it cascading down the outside of it. Fascinated Ethan. He just loved that. So we went over there and sat by the waterfall. And Sharon and Tim went up to the room. And pretty soon, here comes Sharon back. Dad had her eyes. She was crying. Well, then I knew that what I had experienced was true. And it was a long time before I told anybody that story. I finally related it to Tim one day. He said, "You know, should I remember that?" He said, "I didn't think of it at the time how what Brother Jensen was trying to say." Of course, Brother Jensen knew. And what he didn't know was that he had came in after we had went to the restaurant, and he was coming home after coming down from the room after he had learned that she had expired. And so anyway, Sharon came down and told us. And she said, "You knew that, didn't you, Dad?" And I said, "Well, I can't say I knew it." I said, "I had a strong suspicion." And let her quote that. But she said, she said, "I know that's why you kept Ethan back to not go up there." So anyway, he had seen that Grandma was gone. And seeing the reaction everybody had. So then he asked me, he said, "Can I see Grandma?" I said, "Of course you can." And I said, "You want to remember, Grandma's very sick. And she's going to have a lot of tubes and a lot of wires coming out of her body. They'll have a tube in her mouth and have wires from her fingers and sensors from her body." So I said, "It's going to look like Grandma was hurting." But I said, "Grandma was not hurting." So anyway, we went up there. And he wanted to see Grandma. I held him in my arms. We walked in there, and I just reached up and touched her forehead. And he said, "Can I touch Grandma?" I said, "Well, of course you can." So I held him down where he could touch her. He said, "She's cold." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Grandma's cold, is dead. Now you know the difference." I said, "Feel me, and that's the way Grandma used to feel. And this is the way Grandma feels now, because I said her spirit has left her body." Well, he accepted that. What would I say? I'm going to say I'm real proud of him. That's not probably the best way to say it. But it was pleasing to know that he could accept that grandma was gone, and not, there was no look of fear or no look of anguish, no look of anger of any kind on her face, just a peaceful look. And he just accepted that as she's okay, she's with God. And I said to him, he said to me, he asked me if grandma was with God or the angels or something to that effect. And not wanting to confuse death and religion in any way, I said, I believe that grandma is at peace. And wherever she is, her spirit is happy. And he accepted that. And he never had a problem with accepting death. Of course, he'd had we'd had another experience where he knew, many of you here knew Glenn and Mildred's daughter, Julie, and her husband Aaron. When he died, he was a great friend of my oldest boy, oldest grandson, Ethan. Used to throw him up in the air and catch him and set him up in the trees so he could climb the trees and do all kinds of things with him. Well, when Aaron died, we went to his funeral, went to his wake, and Tim and his first wife had already separated, and so we were at our house getting ready to go to the funeral with Danielle, and she got Ethan ready to go, and she said, now you go in and sit down and stay clean. Don't you get dirty. I want you to be clean to go to the funeral. Well, I was sitting in the living room. I was dressed and ready to go also. He climbed up on my lap. He took the remote control out of my hand and put it on mute, looked at me, said, are you going to say anything? I said, that's okay, Grandpa. I said, Grandpa, don't care if he hears a commercial or not. He said, Grandpa, I said, what do you want? He says, what's a funeral? I looked at him. I thought, So again, I didn't want to get him confused about religion. His mother was a strong belief in her, what she believed, which wasn't always compatible with what Tim believed. And Tim and Danielle didn't always agree on everything that they thought they believed either, as far as that goes. And not wanting to create any friction or any problem with any of them, I said, a funeral is a meeting that we have, a get-together that they have for people who've known someone who has died. And I said, now we'll go over there and we'll see Aaron. He will be there. But I said, his spirit won't be there. I said, he'll just be silent and sitting there all dressed up for us to see. But I said, everybody that knew Aaron can come together and they can share with each other the things which they knew that they remembered that made them happy or made them glad or things that they remembered about Aaron that they liked. And I said, they will share these things with one another, and things that you did and that were important to you, if you want to share them with them, I'll give you an opportunity to. But I said, Aaron cannot remember, he cannot see, he cannot hear, he doesn't know anything that's going on. But I said, as long as you live, Aaron's memory will live in your mind as long as you keep it there. And that's what this is for. I said, a funeral is a place to exchange reminiscences of things that happened in your life with him. Oh, okay. Give her back my remote. He was gone. Well, he knew it was somber, but he didn't know. It was something that nobody ever bothered took the time to explain to him what a funeral was, and he wanted to know what it was that we were getting into, that he had to be cleaned up and couldn't get cleaned up for. Well, anyway, he had that experience before Joe passed away. And at home somewhere, I have one of the most precious pictures you will ever see. Here's Ethan standing at mother's casket, her grandmother's casket, all dressed up. And there got his hand on her hand. And Jakey's standing there beside him with one hand on the casket and one hand on Ethan. And they're both looking at her. And they're not crying. They're not laughing. They're just as sober as they can be. But they're interested in looking at mother. Jakey's shirt tail's hanging out. His stepmother didn't want that to be seen. Oh, you can't let anybody see that picture. But it's exactly the way those boys were. And to me, what is precious about that picture is they love their grandmother, but they accepted the fact that she's in a better place. And they are willing I shouldn't say wanting. They are content with that satisfaction, and I am too. But whenever you see my daughter come in, I don't care if you say anything to her, I just when you didn't, but if you do, you do, it don't make any difference. She's my walking miracle. We've had several miracles in our family, but that was the most outstanding experience. And though I didn't fear being kicked out of the synagogue, I did have the fear that we might be accused of being uncaring parents. And I didn't want that to be ever a part. I wasn't worried so much about myself, I guess, at the time as I was with Joe, because she is a very timid person. It was probably been devastating to her. I'm not even sure that she was aware where this was leading up to at the time, because she was in such a state of shock. But I seen where it was coming from, and I could see what was going on, and it leaped right out at me like, you do have something to be concerned for. But God seen us through it, and I'm thankful for it. I give him the praise and the honor and the glory, and thank you very much.
Well, I was accused of trying to kill my son.
That would be awfully hard to take.